It's 12 noon. You're at Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to the reading of the Arizona Daily Star for Monday, February 16th. Mark DeGroft with you. From Munich, a top European Union official on Sunday rejected the notion that Europe faces civilizational erasure, pushing back a criticism of the continent by the Trump administration. EU Foreign Press Chief Kaja Kallas addressed the Munich Security Conference a day after U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio offered a somewhat reassuring message to European allies. He struck a less aggressive tone than President J.D. Vance did in lecturing them at the same gathering last year, but maintained a firm tone on Washington's intent to reshape the transatlantic alliance and push its policy priorities. Kallas alluded to criticism in the United States National Security Strategy that was released in December, which asserted that economic stagnation in Europe is eclipsed by the real and more stark prospect of civilizational erasure. It suggested that Europe is being enfeebled by its immigration policies, declining birth rates, censorship of free speech, and suppression of political opposition, and a total loss of national identities and self-confidence. Contrary to what some people may say, woke, decadent Europe is not facing civilizational erasure, Kallas told the conference. In fact, people still want to join our club, and not just fellow Europeans, she added, saying she was told when visiting Canada last year that many people there have an interest in joining the EU. Kallas rejected what she called European bashing. We are, you know, pushing humanity forward, trying to defend human rights and all this, which is actually bringing also prosperity for people. So that's why it's very hard for me to believe these accusations. In his conference speech, Rubio said that an end to the transatlantic era is neither our goal nor our wish, adding that our home may be in the Western Hemisphere, but we will always be a child of Europe. He made clear that the Trump administration is sticking to its guns on issues such as immigration, migration, trade, and climate, and European officials who addressed the gathering made clear that they in turn will stand by their values, including their approach to free speech, climate change, and free trade. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said on Saturday that Europe must defend the vibrant, free, and diverse societies that we represent, showing that people who look different to each other can live peacefully together, and that isn't against the tenor of our times. Rather, it's what makes us strong, he said. Kallas said Rubio's speech sent an important message that America and Europe are and will remain intertwined. It is also clear that we don't see eye to eye on all the issues, and this will remain the case as well, but I think we can work from there, she said. Trump revoked the 2009 endangerment finding, which has long been the central basis for U.S. action to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and fight climate change. But in making the announcement this past week, Trump and Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin made false claims regarding the government declaration, climate change, and energy. Here's a closer look at the facts. Trump, known as the endangerment finding, this determination had no basis in fact, had none whatsoever, and it had no basis in law. The facts, this is false. The endangerment finding was adopted in 2009 by the EPA after the United States Supreme Court ruled in 2007 that greenhouse gases and air pollutants can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. The idea that the endangerment finding has no basis in law is ludicrous, said Ann Carlson, who is a professor of environmental law at the University of California, Los Angeles. The Supreme Court in Massachusetts versus EPA specifically directed the Environmental Protection Agency to determine whether greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. The endangerment finding is the result. Scientific evidence to support the endangerment finding was provided by the EPA at the time of its inception is still available on the agency's website today. Multiple federal courts have upheld the endangerment funding and findings since it was adopted 16 years ago. Quote, we've basically stopped all the windmills in this country. It's the most expensive energy you can get. The facts. Onshore wind is one of the cheapest sources of electricity generation, with new wind farms expected to produce around $30 per megawatt hour. This according to July estimates from the Energy Information Administration. This compares to a new natural gas plant, around $65 per megawatt hour, or a new advanced nuclear reactor, which runs over $80. Offshore wind is among the sources of new power generation that will cost the most to build and operate at $88 per megawatt hour, the EIA said in July. Trump. When asked about the cost to health and the environment, Trump said, quote, "It has nothing to do with public health. This is all a scam, a giant scam. This was a rip-off of the country by Obama and Biden, and let's say Obama started it and got it rolling and a terrible rip-off," end quote. The facts. Thousands of peer-reviewed scientific studies connect health harms to climate change. They find increasing deaths from heat waves, extreme weather such as hurricanes and floods, and air pollution from worsening wildfires. In 2021, a study in the Nature Climate Change calculated that globally, about 9,700 people die each year from heat-related deaths that are attributable to human-caused climate change, based on data from 732 cities, including more than 200 in the United States. A separate study last year listed dozens of climate change health harms and concluded, using the EPA's own calculation method, that the health costs are at least $10 billion a year and probably much more. The science of climate change dates back nearly 170 years to studies done by American Eunice Foote showing that carbon dioxide heated cylinders with thermometers inside are more than ambient air. The first national climate assessment done in 2000, before Obama and Biden, concluded that climate variability and change are likely to increase morbidity and mortality risks. Zeldin, the Obama and Biden administration used the endangerment finding to steamroll into existence a left-wing wish, including electric vehicle mandates. The facts. Trump has made this claim before. There is no federal mandate to force the purchase of EVAs. But if you look at some of the tables that were in the Biden rules, you could see that there were a variety of different ways that companies could comply with the standards, said Kerry Jenks, who is the executive director of Harvard Law School's Environmental and Energy Law Program. The endangerment finding nor the regulations mandated a shift from one type of vehicle to another. Former President Joe Biden did set up a non-binding goal that EVs make up half of the new cars sold by the year 2030. Trump issued an executive order on his first day in office, revoking that goal. Biden's policies tightened restrictions on pollution from gas-powered cars and trucks, trying to make an effort to encourage Americans to buy EVs and car companies to shift from gas-powered vehicles to electric cars. From Washington, the United States' 250th anniversary arrives amid deep political divisions and heightened anxiety over whether the country's representative government can be sustained. The bitter partnership and partisanship is set aside, at least temporarily, in the rotunda of the National Archives. This is home to the nation's founding documents, including the one commemorated this year, the Declaration of Independence. The room is filled with a silent sense of reverence as visitors gaze down at the parchment, a beacon of inspiration for people around the world for more than two centuries, secured under bulletproof glass. Its significance was not lost on those who filtered in on a recent day amid a national reckoning over Trump's aggressive immigration enforcement actions that have led to the killings of two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis and concerns about attacks on constitutional rights. The Associated Press interviewed visitors after they viewed the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. They acknowledged the country's ideological divides, but in many cases expressed hope that the nation would repair itself. With the rotunda's paintings of the Founding Fathers as a backdrop, they gave complicated responses when asked whether the U.S. lives up to the ideals of its founding documents and where it might be headed. Ryan O'Neill from West Bloomfield, Michigan, said that while the U.S. is split politically, he finds hope in the documents at the National Archives because they guided the country for 250 years. We've not yet lived up to everything that we had hoped to, he said, but we are continuing to progress and get closer to that. The archives had a special exhibit, The American Story, to mark the 250th anniversary and highlight that complex history, mixing the country's accomplishments and advances with images showing its darker moments. O'Neill, who's 42 years old, said that the U.S. was in similar divisive situations throughout its history and always managed to regroup. The one constant, he said, is that the country's political pendulum always swings. Kevin Sullivan traveled to Washington from Milwaukee to visit with his wife and children and attend the confirmation of their oldest grandson. He acknowledged that the U.S. is in a divisive moment, but said it wasn't the only one the country faced. So I have some faith that we'll pull some of the uglier partisan disputes between us. Sullivan, who's 69, said he supported some of Trump's goals, including securing the southern border, but was conflicted about the president's approach. He opposed Democratic threats to shut off funding for the Department of Homeland Security without drastic reforms to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and other federal law enforcement agencies, but also said he didn't like the mass deportation policy. His advice to lawmakers and the president would be to get away from the cameras and hold meaningful discussions to find solutions. The Reverend Michael Stokes, a priest of the Church of England, visited friends in the Washington area. Before heading to the Rotunda, he saw the Magna Carta, the English document signed in 1215, that set a price for the people and served as a model for the U.S. system of government. Morgan Whitman, an executive assistant, was in Washington on business from Miami and saw the documents for the first time. She said reading them created a mix of emotions. The ideals were lofty, she said, but there's also a chorus of the feelings of hypocrisy because Thomas Jefferson argued for a passage opposing slavery that was not included. So I think we have this document that fought for independence and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, she said. My only wish is that it was for everybody at the time. Whitman, who's 25, said she's grateful for being granted rights that many others around the world do not have, but also said she is afraid that some of those are under threat. She cited federal agents killing a Veterans Affairs ICU nurse, Alex Preddy, in Minneapolis. Take immigration out of it. These are American citizens that are being harmed now, she said, and that is unacceptable. Tucson and regional news at 13 after. The Pima County Sheriff's Department got more than 4,000 calls within 24 hours after the release of videos of a masked person on Nancy Guthrie's porch. Many tips will be worthless. Others could have merit. Experts say one thing is certain, they can't be ignored. Tips can solve crimes, big or small, and eerie images of a mysterious male covered head to toe have been the most significant clue shared with the public during Guthrie's nearly two-week-old disappearance in the Tucson area. Late Friday night, the investigation prompted officers to block off a road into a neighborhood located about 2 miles from Guthrie's house. A parade of sheriffs and FBI vehicles were waved through the roadblock, including forensic vehicles. The Pima County Sheriff's Department said the activity was a part of the Guthrie investigation. No arrests followed the massive police action. A similar high-profile effort days earlier in Rio Rico also failed to result in an arrest. Sorting through the tips is a tremendous amount of work, said Roberto Villasenor, a former Tucson police chief. In a situation like this, you really cannot do what's been done without tips and public input, he said. We have the process this season, but once that is done and is exhausted, it's hard to move forward without additional information coming in. The Pima County Sheriff and the FBI announced phone numbers and a website to offer tips about the apparent kidnapping of Guthrie, the 84-year-old mother of NBC Today co-anchor Savannah Guthrie. Several hundred detectives and agents have been assigned to the case, that the Sheriff's Department said. The FBI has said that it collected more than 13,000 tips since February 1st, the day Guthrie was reported missing. The Sheriff's Department, meanwhile, has said it has taken at least 18,000 calls. Every tip is reviewed for credibility, relevance, and information that could be acted upon by law enforcement, the FBI said Thursday, adding that the effort is a 24-hour operation. It said it won't comment on the tips that have been received. Law enforcement agencies are continuing to gather potential evidence. Investigators found several gloves, the nearest about 2 miles from Guthrie's home, and submitted them for lab analysis. They collected DNA from Guthrie's property, which doesn't belong to Guthrie or those in close contact with her, the department said. Investigators are working to identify who it belongs to. The sheriff released a statement that stressed how his department is working with the FBI. The Pima County Sheriff's Department and the FBI continue to work jointly on the case. Our strong partnership is critical, and we remain fully committed to this collaborative investigation. Evidence requiring forensic analysis being sent to the same out-of-state lab that has been used since the beginning of the case, something local FBI leadership agreed to, the department said. Many U.S. crimes for years have been cracked with a tip. In 1995, the brother and sister-in-law of Ted Kaczynski recognized certain tones in an anonymous, widely published anti-technology manifesto. Known by the FBI as the Unabomber, Kaczynski was found living in a shack in Montana and subsequently admitted to committing 16 bombings over 17 years, which killed 3 people. The 1989 murders of an Ohio woman and 2 teen daughters in Florida were solved 3 years later when St. Petersburg police asked the public if they recognized handwriting found in the victim's car. A former neighbor led investigators to Oba Chandler. Retired Detroit homicide investigator Ira Todd recalled how images from a gas station camera solved the disappearance and death of a 3-month-old baby and stopped authorities from pursuing the wrong person in 2001. A niece of this guy saw it on television and says, "Hey, that's my uncle." The murders of 4 University of Idaho students in 2022 generated nearly 40,000 tips to state and federal authorities. None had a direct role in the capture of Brian Koberger, but the public's involvement, nonetheless, was absolutely important, said Lieutenant Darren Gilbertson of the Idaho State Police. "That's one of the things we kept us going for weeks," he said, while authorities awaited DNA and other evidence. Gilbertson said much of the early vetting in the Idaho murders was done by the FBI. He said agents and analysts who were screening tips had a good grasp of what information could be spiked and what could be handled up to key investigators. Some tips arrived by regular mail. "I am hopeful," said Villasenor, the former Tucson police chief. "I've seen cases where simpler and less detailed information has helped bring somebody about. Maybe someone recognized in clothing, maybe the bag. You never know what someone may key on." An Arizona Auditor General's report on the University of Arizona's internal control over financial reporting for fiscal 2025 says the university's global campus overstated revenue by more than $250,000, or 13.13%, and that the U of A misspent $78,000 when a former employee wasn't removed from the payroll system after resigning. The audit report also found the U of A's and its global campus control processes over IT systems and data weren't sufficient, and that some miscellaneous U of A expenses were not documented properly. Auditor General Lindsay Perry said that the October 2025 report's sole scope was the U of A's internal control over its financial reporting and didn't consider the effectiveness of its overall internal control. A former U of A employee, whose role involved working on federally funded research and developmental grant projects, resigned in June of 2023, and the U of A continued to pay his salary and additional employee-related expenses through the next 1 year and 10 months. The total net loss to the university was $78,114. While the issue is isolated, the university recognizes the importance of reinforcing preventive and detective controls to mitigate the risk of similar occurrences in the future, said the U of A's Chief Financial Officer John Arnold in a response, with fellow administrators included in the audit report. The causes for the lapse included the U of A's College of Agriculture, Life, and Environmental Sciences. Only human resources employee was transferring to a new position and failed to inform other employees to process the individual's resignation. U of A's human resources processes were decentralized and oversight was inconsistent, and the principal investigator of the grant project didn't ensure that employees paid from federal grant money were working on the project, the report found. The university has made efforts to reclaim uncovered amounts from the ex-employee by filing an Arizona Department of Revenue lien on the person's state tax refund. The university also conducted a review of all the college's employees during the months of April and May of 2025 and determined that no other former employees were paid their past resignation dates. The U of A Global Campus, the university's online university, miscalculated its 90/10 revenue percentage for fiscal year 2025. A federal law primarily for for-profit institutions says they need to accrue at least 10% of revenue from non-federal sources, while 90% can come from federal student aid, such as Pell Grants or Stafford loans. The miscalculation was by 0.13% or $257,801. Public universities, including the U of A, Arizona State University, and Northern Arizona University, receive a combination of state and federal funding and tuition to operate on. The U of A spent $8,295 on entertainment, food, and beverages and other costs through purchasing cards without following its policies of documenting the public purpose behind each purchase and their benefit to the university. The purchases included 40 tickets to an NBA basketball game, a laptop computer and Bluetooth equipment for a U of A professor, a retirement party for a U of A employee, 20 Target gift cards given to middle school students during a College of Public Health event, and 5 custom-made footballs for the honorary football captain program. Arnold and administrators said that the U of A revised and then published a new policy on purchasing card violations in January of this year, which improves compliance requirements and includes potential suspension for unresolved compliance issues. A man has been indicted on 2 counts of first-degree felony murder and dozens of other charges stemming from a helicopter crash earlier this month in Arizona that killed 2 people during a shootout with police. Terrell Story, 50 years old, fired on officers from multiple rooftops in Flagstaff residential neighborhood over almost 2 hours on the night of February 4th, according to police. He was captured about the same time as the helicopter crash and hospitalized for gunshot wounds that were not life-threatening. Trooper paramedic Hunter Bennett, 28, and the pilot Robert Skanky, 61, were both killed. The indictment does not specify whether Story fired at the helicopter with the semi-automatic long rifle that police said he was using. The cause of the crash remains under investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board. Under Arizona law, suspects can be charged with felony murder if they cause somebody's death in the course of and in furtherance of another crime, such as burglary, kidnapping, or sexual assault. Coconino County Attorney Amon Barker said on Friday that he anticipates Story will be arraigned on February 23rd, but declined further comment on the facts of the case. The indictment names as victims 25 law enforcement officers who had responded to the scene and people who live in homes in the area. It totals 60 criminal counts, including the 2 felony murder charges for the deaths of Bennett and Skanky. Other charges include aggravated assault, burglary, disorderly conduct, and endangerment. Story remained hospitalized as of Friday, said John Paxton, who is with the Coconino County Sheriff's Office. He's being held on $5 million bond and is represented by the Coconino County Public Defender's Office. Our sympathy and condolences go to the families of the 2 men who were killed in the helicopter crash, said Public Defender Jennifer Stock on Friday. She advised that she was interested to see the results of the NTSB investigation. The confrontation with Story began when officers responded to a domestic violence call, according to Flagstaff Police Chief Sean Connolly. As the officer spoke with the victim in the front yard, Story shot at them from the back of the residence with a semi-automatic rifle. A protracted gun battle ensued, with the suspect hopping from roof to roof in the neighborhood while shooting at officers, the chief said. The helicopter crew had been playing a common role, helping officers on the ground. Before crashing, the aircraft was making a pass back to the shootout scene when it slowed to almost a hover at about 1,000 feet over a hilltop, according to public flight path data. Skanky was a longtime resident of Kingman, Arizona, and had been hired by the Arizona Department of Public Safety in May of 2021. He previously served in the U.S. Marine Corps and was married with four children. Bennett was an honors graduate of Arizona State University and the top graduate of his 2023 Arizona Law Enforcement Academy class. He transferred to an air rescue unit in 2024 and months later married his high school sweetheart. Barker said in a statement announcing the indictment that his office was committed to pursuing this case with the diligence and the care that it requires. Our hearts remain with the families of Hunter Bennett and Robert Skanky, and with all of the families impacted by this incident, Barker said. Two pedestrians were killed in unrelated hit-and-run crashes on Friday night in Midtown, police say. At about 7:15 p.m., Dennis Thosey, 35 years old, was found severely injured in the street in the 2100 block of North Country Club Road, just south of East Grant Road. He died at the hospital, police said. The driver fled after the crash. However, damaged vehicle parts were found in the roadway belonging to what is believed to be a Nissan, the release said. Thosey was struck in the northbound lanes of traffic, though his exact position has not yet been determined. In an unrelated crash about the same time on Friday night, an unidentified pedestrian was struck and killed while crossing North Alvernon Way near East Pima Street, police said. At about 7:15 p.m., the person was crossing in the 1700 block of North Alvernon Way and was struck by what is believed to be a dark blue 2011 or through 14 Hyundai Sonata traveling northbound. The driver of the Hyundai fled. The pedestrian was then struck by a second northbound vehicle, the release said. The driver of that vehicle remained on the scene when was cooperative with the investigation. The pedestrian's fatal injuries were not believed to be caused by the second vehicle. The name of the pedestrian on the Alvernon crash is being withheld pending family notification, the release said. In both of these crashes, detectives are checking the area for video surveillance that might have captured the collision or vehicles in the area prior to and after the crashes. There have been six pedestrians killed in Tucson crashes so far this year, according to police. Today in history. In 1862, on this date, the Civil War Battle of Fort Donelson in Tennessee ended with the surrender of some 12,000 Confederate soldiers. Union General Ulysses S. Grant's victory earned him the moniker Unconditional Surrender Grant. In 1923, the burial chamber of King Tutankhamun's recently unearthed tomb was unsealed in Egypt by English archaeologist Howard Carter. In 1960, the nuclear submarine USS Triton departed New London, Connecticut on the first submerged circumnavigation of the globe by a vessel. In 1996, 11 people died in a fiery collision between an Amtrak passenger train and the Maryland commuter train in Silver Spring, Maryland. In 2018, Special Counsel Robert Mueller indicted 13 Russians and three Russian companies on charges of staging a plot to disrupt the 2016 U.S. presidential election via a social media trolling program aimed in part at helping Trump win the presidency. In 2024, Russia's prison agency announced that Alexei Navalny, activist and Russian opposition leader, had died in the Arctic penal colony where he was serving a 19-year sentence on charges of extremism. Navalny's death brought about outrage and criticism from world leaders toward Russian President Vladimir Putin. In business, Barbie manufacturer Mattel took a hit this week after its Superstall doll failed to deliver. The El Segundo, California-based company behind many of the world's most iconic toys was walloped in the stock market. Its shares plunged 25% on Wednesday after it announced that the holiday season sales were weak and that it expects another slow year. It was over-optimistic about how many Barbies and other product consumers would want and had to slash prices to move them, even as it grappled with higher costs from tariffs, analysts said. 2025 was marked by uncertainty, said Ynon Kreiz, who's chief executive of the company, and he said the earnings were unveiled on Tuesday. While Mattel's Hot Wheels were hot, and its party card game Uno attracted new fans, Barbie has been struggling. Mattel's Fisher-Price line, which makes educational toys for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers, also lagged. The doll and its many variants have been losing momentum since her latest 15 minutes in the spotlight following the 2023 hit movie Barbie. This year, Mattel says it will increase its focus on making more digital games and toys tied to the movie franchise. Last year, its net sales were about $5.3 billion, down 1% from the year before, according to the company's unaudited financial statements. Its projection for this year also disappointed investors. The company lost close to $1 billion in market value as investors dumped its shares. The movie that was the fun half of the Barbenheimer summer took in close to $1.5 billion at the box office and rejuvenated buzz around the 60-something Barbie doll, sparking more than $150 million in sales from dolls and its other related products. At the time, it seemed to validate the toy maker's strategy of turning its legacy brands into modern media properties with live-action films and other things. It's not been able to repeat that success yet, and that failure has weighed on its earnings. And despite efforts to create buzz around the Barbie brand, including a diabetes Barbie and an autism Barbie, gross billings for Barbie products slid 11% last year, following a similar decline in 2024. Mattel on Tuesday said it plans to double down on its strategy to become, as its CEO called it, an IP-driven play and family entertainment business. That means it wants to make more money from video games and movies. U.S. inflation was fairly mild at the start of the year, defying concerns from a bigger jump and boosting expectations that the Federal Reserve will deliver more interest rate cuts. The consumer price index rose 0.2% in January, the smallest gain since July, and restrained by lower energy costs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics data that came out on Friday. An underlying metric known as the core CPI, which excludes food and energy, advanced as expected from a month earlier. January inflation readings have been strong in recent years, often beating expectations as companies tend to raise their prices at the start of the year. Many economists have called for an even bigger pickup in the core CPI for that reason, as well as predictions that firms would pass along more tariff-related costs to its consumers. And while services costs picked up last month, prices of core goods remained stable. The core CPI rose from a year ago by the least since 2021, and the overall gauge also eased on an annual basis. Markets rallied in relief as the core figure was relatively tame and came in line with the median projection. Treasury yields fell and the S&P 500 fluctuated, while traders boosted bets for the Federal Reserve to cut interest rate 3 times this year. And alongside recent indications of a stabilizing labor market, Fed officials will likely want to see further inflation progress before lowering any interest rates. And turning to letters to the editor at 25 Till, Mr. Trump may have finally gone too far. His decision to overturn a massive number of environmental restrictions, ignoring centuries of scientific observation and conclusions, has definitely destroyed America's hard-earned global leadership in the world's crucial effort to save the Earth's people from their most short-sighted choices. Perhaps enough Republicans in Congress will love their grandchildren and great-grandchildren enough to find the courage to overturn this decision, and maybe more courage to pursue the result that we really need, a successful impeachment of this totally unqualified and dangerous man. I desperately hope so. So writes John Bryan from the Northeast Side. John Glaspie writes, my residency in Tucson is fast approaching 30 years, so I have plenty of experience getting around town, but I cannot support the propositions as stated. For one thing, they support growth, whereas I believe that sustainability is the higher priority. That is, Tucson, Pima County does not and will not have the water to continue growing. The CAP water coming here is very likely to soon stop completely as the Colorado River dries up. Tucson will have to struggle to supply residents, and agriculture that depends on it will not be possible. Another important subject not included in the RTA plan is to support the increased use of electric vehicles, which, by reducing emissions, can slow the climate change that is drying up the Southwest. Let's start thinking for real about the future. So now Donald Trump is calling an Olympic athlete a loser because he dared to suggest that things in the U.S. are not ideal. Sigh. I can only wish we had a president who had some maturity and intellectual depth instead of calling names like an immature school kid. In contrast, in an 1846 letter to Horace Greeley, Frederick Douglass wrote, "The best friend of a nation is he who most faithfully rebukes her for her sins, and her worst enemy who, under the garb of patriotism, seeks to excuse, palliate, or defend them." Totally agree. So, Mr. President, grow up. As the same goes for all of those who respond to criticism of the United States with the specious comment, just move somewhere else. Freedom of speech is an essential and crucial right. It's a shame that the president doesn't feel the same way. That was written by Merle McFeeters. Craig Hill, who lives in Oracle, writes, I'm going to hope that all lawyers in the United States write a letter to Pam Bondi stating what a disgraceful show she put on in front of the American public. Bringing note cards on different people how to denigrate them instead of answering questions. She is truly lacking in integrity. This is shameful as the Attorney General of the United States of America. Loyal M. Johnson writes, an interesting article to The Star detailed the reduction in business for Chipotle Mexican Grill. Although the article suggested that the decline was associated with the effect of tariffs, increased prices, and the general uncertainty surrounding Trump's administration policies, the article may have missed a major point. 12% of the U.S. adult population is currently using GLP-1 products, Ozempic or Wegovy, to control weight gain. There are 267 million adults in the United States, meaning 32 million adults are using this product at monstrous cost. Because these people are eating far less and a significant percentage of their budget is going to the drug, this huge reduction in food consumption spells an economic problems not only for restaurants and fast food outlets, but grocery stores and eventually farmers. Apparently no good turn goes unpunished. And Leslie Carney from the East Side writes, our Attorney General did a great job of performing to her audience of one, Donald J. Trump. The audience Pam Bondi should have been performing for was the victims. However, congratulations on keeping your job. I'm not an attorney, however, I believe that our AG should be fired and charged with dereliction of duty. A.G. Bondi gave all the victims a slap in the face when she wouldn't even turn to look at them during the hearing. The new MAGA politics must be stopped. Don't look out the window. Go to the streets, go to the polls, and vote yes on getting the politicians out. Deborah Caldwell from Green Valley, as a taxpayer and a resident, I want to vote yes to our RTA plan, but believe it's looking too far into the future. Explanations for this plan all talk about how unforeseeable things happen to cause previous work slowdown. None of us can see into the future this far and cannot reasonably be expected to. For this reason alone, I will be voting no on the proposals. come back to us with a shorter term, maximum 10-year plan that alone will make it more reasonable in scope and more realistic goals. And Sheldon Clark from Vail writes, as one of the multi-generational family of U of A alumni, it's gut-wrenching to watch the athletic department overwrite the names of the U of A institutions and heroes for vainglorious motivation and money. We see enough of this at the national level. Turning to National World News at 20 till, from West Palm Beach, Florida, Trump said on Sunday that members of his newly created Board of Peace have pledged $5 billion towards rebuilding war-ravaged Gaza and will commit thousands of personnel to international stabilization and police forces for the territory. The pledges will be formally announced when the board members gather in Washington on Thursday for their first meeting, he said. The Board of Peace will prove to be the most consequential international body in history, and it is my honor to serve as its chairman, Trump said in a social media posting announcing the pledges. He did not detail which member nations were making the pledges for reconstruction or contribute personnel to the stabilization force. Rebuilding the Palestinian territory would be a daunting endeavor. The United Nations, the World Bank, and European Union have estimated that the reconstruction of the territory will cost around $70 billion. Few places in the Gaza Strip were left unscathed by more than 2 years of Israeli bombardment. The ceasefire also calls for an armed international stabilization force to keep security and ensure the disarming of the militant Hamas group, a key demand of Israel. Thus far, a few countries have expressed interest in taking part in this proposed force. The October 10th U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal attempted to halt a more than two-year war between Israel and Hamas. While the heaviest fighting has subsided, Israeli forces have carried out repeated airstrikes and frequently fire on Palestinians near military-held zones. It's not clear how many of the more than 20 members of the Board of Peace will attend the first meeting. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who held White House talks with Trump last week, is not expected to be there. Trump's new board was first seen as a mechanism focused on ending the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza. But it has taken shape with his ambition for a far broader mandate of resolving global crises and appears to be the latest U.S. effort to sidestep the United Nations as Trump aims to reset the post-World War II international order. Many of America's top allies in Europe and elsewhere have declined to join what they suspect may be an attempt to rival the Security Council. Trump also confirmed that Thursday's meeting will take place at the U.S. Institute of Peace, which the State Department announced in December was renaming the Donald J. Trump U.S. Institute of Peace. From West Palm Beach, Florida, lawmakers in the White House offered no signs of compromise yesterday in their battle over the oversight of federal immigration officers that has led to a pause in funding for the Department of Homeland Security. A partial government shutdown began on Saturday after congressional Democrats and Trump failed to agree on legislation to fund the department through September. Democrats are demanding changes to how immigration operations are conducted after the fatal shootings of U.S. citizens Alex Preddy and Renee Good by federal officers in Minneapolis last month. Congress is on recess until February 23rd. Both sides appear dug into their positions. The impasse affects agencies such as the Transportation Security Administration, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the United States Coast Guard, the Secret Service, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The work at ICE and CBP goes on unabated because Trump's tax and spending law cut from the 2025 provided billions more to those agencies that can be tapped for departmental operations. About 90% of DHS employees were to continue working during the shutdown, but will do so without pay. White House Border Czar Tom Hohen said that the administration was unwilling to agree to the Democrats' demands that federal officers clearly identify themselves and remove masks during operations. I don't like the mask either, Homan said, but these men and women have to protect themselves. From the Digest, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi arrived Sunday from Tehran from Geneva, where the second round of nuclear negotiations with the United States will take place, Iranian state media reported. Oman will mediate the talks in Geneva, the IRNA state-run news agency reported. From Russia, a Ukrainian drone strike ignited fires at one of Russia's Black Sea ports, officials said, ahead of fresh talks aimed at ending the nearly four-year-old war. Two people were wounded in the attack on the port of Taman, officials said. From the Indian Ocean, U.S. military forces boarded another sanctioned tanker in the ocean after tracking the vessel from the Caribbean Sea in an effort to target illicit oil connected to Venezuela, according to the Pentagon on Sunday. From Italy, an off-trail avalanche killed two skiers and injured another yesterday on the Italian side of Mont Blanc Massif, officials said. 15 rescuers, 3 canine units, 2 helicopters took part in the search and rescue efforts. From Colombia, Colombian President Gustavo Petro said on yesterday that he would accept a proposal that had been made by the National Liberation Army, the nation's largest remaining rebel group, to allow an independent commission to investigate the group's alleged links to the drug trade. And from Gaza, Indonesia's military said yesterday that up to 8,000 troops are expected to be ready by the end of June for a potential deployment to Gaza as part of the humanitarian and peace mission. From Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, the father of a 12-year-old victim of the mass shooting in a remote Canadian town tearfully recounted the desperate hours spent trying to learn what happened to her, only to find out from an older girl and not the authorities. Lance Young told CTV News on Wednesday that his son Ethan texted, "I love you," shortly after 3 p.m. on Tuesday, and then called a short time later to say he was hiding in a utility room at his school in the small mountain community of Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, but he didn't know where his sister Kylie was. The family would find out hours later that Kylie Smith was one of the 8 victims, mostly children, who were killed in attacks at the school and the home of the 18-year-old shooting suspect, who died from an apparent self-inflicted wound. While looking for Kylie, Young said he walked around the local recreation center where students were reuniting with their families for about 6 hours, but the police wouldn't tell him anything. "I went home not knowing where my daughter was until a high school kid came here and told us her story about trying to save my daughter's life. The police didn't tell us anything. We had to find out through the community and through kids and rumors in the stands." The motive for Canada's deadliest attack in years remained unclear on Thursday. Mourners braved frigid cold on Wednesday night to grieve the victims, with Mayor Daryl Kurkawa telling them it's okay to cry. Krakawa said he described the town as one big family and encouraged people to reach out and support one another, especially the families of those who died in the attack. "The community must support victims' families forever, not only in the days and weeks to come," he said. Jesse Van Rootseller, whom investigators identified as the shooter, had a history of police visits to her home to check on her mental health, according to authorities. Royal Canadian Mounted Police Deputy Commissioner Dwayne MacDonald said Van Rootseller was first killed her mother and stepbrother in a family home before attacking the nearby school. The town of 2,700 people, located in the Canadian Rockies, is more than 600 miles northeast of Vancouver, near the provincial border with Alberta. Police said the victims included a 39-year-old teacher and 5 students, aged 12 to 13. The killings at the home occurred first, MacDonald said. A young family member at the home went to a neighbor who called police. The bodies of the suspect's mother, who was also 39, and her 11-year-old stepbrother were found at the home. At the school, one victim was found in a stairwell. The rest were found in the library. MacDonald believed the suspect was not related to any of the victims at the school. "There's no information at this point that anyone was specifically targeted," MacDonald said. Police recovered a long gun and a modified handgun. McDonald said officers arrived at the school 2 minutes after the initial call. When they arrived, shots were fired in their direction. Parents, grandparents, sisters and brothers in Tumblr Ridge will wake up without someone they love. The nation mourns you, and Canada stands behind you, an emotional Prime Minister Mark Carney said as he arrived in Parliament. Carley planned to visit Tumblr Ridge on Friday. Turning to sports at about 9 minutes till. Well, in Arizona basketball, the first Arizona rotation player to miss a game this season, Dwayne Aristoti, was so sick he didn't even appear on the bench. Teammate Koa Pete, struggling to hit shots in his previous two games, didn't get a single one off Saturday against Texas Tech. And then he left the floor for good just after 11 minutes with a lower leg injury that might have affected his mobility and or elevation. Coach Tommy Lloyd said Aristoti could be out for a short while with an unspecified illness, while he said of Pete only that he's being evaluated to determine the extent of his injury. There was also this on Saturday. While hosting a notably shallow and undersized team, the Wildcats were still beaten at their own game, or at least neutralized, in their 78-75 overtime loss to number 16 Texas Tech. Arizona couldn't outscore the Red Raiders in the paint and barely out-rebounded them 41-39. So combining all that with the U of A's February 9th loss at Kansas makes it pretty much official. Adversity, for the first time this season, is hitting the Wildcats, who entered week 23-0 and ranked number 1. How hard it's hitting is difficult to tell, at least in the short run. A 4-point loss at number 9 Kansas is understandable, and an overtime defeat to Texas Tech isn't quite a shocker. But the Cats face an unknown amount of time without two of their key 8 players, and a blueprint may have formed Saturday that the remaining opponents may want to check it out. That is, neutralize the Wildcats' formidable interior, however possible, forcing them to take shots further away from the basket, and maybe even into that 3-point territory they don't normally much bother with. Texas Tech coach Grant McCaslin said his team's ball screen defense helped noticeably for that strategy, as did the Red Raiders' tireless effort. It's about getting them on their heels and pushing them back a little further out where they can't turn the corner. They're not getting inside the elbow and they're not driving down your throat, McCaslin said. They're not throwing it to Kivas at 7 feet and Awaka is not catching it close to the basket, because when they do, they get fouled and they make them. Texas Tech's strategy paid off. Kivas scored below his scoring and shooting percentage averages, with 10 points on 4-for-8 shooting, though Awaka managed 16 points on 5-for-6 shooting while collecting 12 rebounds. And before he left, Pete had just 2 points while hitting 2 of 4 free throws and picking up only 1 rebound. And coming up next for the Cats is number 1 Arizona, 23-2 and 10-2 in the conference, versus number 22 Brigham Young, 19-6 and 7-5. 7 o'clock p.m. Wednesday at the McHale Center. You can watch it on ESPN or listen at 1290 a.m. and 92.5 FM for Spanish. In baseball, the Arizona Diamondbacks defeated the New York Yankees to capture the 2001 World Series, and the team will mark the 25th anniversary of that milestone when the Yankees visit Chase Field this season. The celebration that is scheduled for Saturday, September 19th, will include a 2001 throwback jersey giveaway. Members from the World Series team will be on hand as a part of a commemorative pregame ceremony, recognizing the legacy, impact, and lasting memories of their championship run. In spring training, our goal was to get to the World Series. It was to win the World Series, said Luis Gonzalez as he spoke to the Arizona Republic during an interview in 2018. We believed in our hearts that we could do that. The 3-game series between the Diamondbacks and Yankees this year begins on September 18th, which is a Friday, and the D-backs announced their plans for the 25th anniversary celebration during their annual Most Valuable Party for Advantage members on Saturday, February 14th, at Chase Field. Members from the 2001 team, including Gonzalez, Jay Bell, Damian Miller, and Bob Brenly, were present. The D-backs beat the Yankees in 7 games. Gonzalez delivered the winning hit in Game 7 with a bloop single to the left off closer Mariano Rivera in the bottom of the 9th. Arizona became the fastest expansion franchise in Major League history to win a World Series title, doing so in just its 4th season. It was its first and only World Series championship to date and remains the only major title won by an Arizona-based professional team in the 4 major sports. Formula One Racing is returning to Phoenix, but not for an official race. Red Bull is heading to the Valley for a special one-off event. The event, Red Bull Showdown Showrun Phoenix, is a Formula One demonstration during which Red Bull Racing F1 car, Racing Bulls, the sister team for Red Bull F1 car, as well as other Red Bull Motorsports vehicles, will drive up and down East Jefferson Street between South Central Avenue and South 5th Street on March 14th from 1 to 4 p.m. And while it's not a race, the teams will be in China for the Chinese Grand Prix that weekend. The event promises to be an unforgettable experience that will make spectators' hearts race early as fast as the vehicles on display. It'll be the first time since 1991 that Formula One is appearing in Phoenix. And a quick look at the Olympics, the medal count through 68 events. Remaining at number one is Norway with 12 gold and 7 silver and 7 bronze for a total of 26, that is. Italy has 8 gold, 4 silver, 10 bronze for 22. The United States, 5 gold, 8 silver, 4 bronze for a total of 17. At the bottom is Bulgaria, 0 gold, 0 silver, 2 bronze for a total of 2. And that's the reading of the Arizona Daily Star for this Monday. Mark DeGroft with you. Take care.